So I know you've got a lot going on, but remember, I'm here for you. So bother me when no one's listening, because I will. Bother me when it feels like it won't get better, because it can. Bother me because you're never a bother. Whether it's a low point or a crisis, get help for yourself or a friend. Learn more at neverabother.org or call or text 988, available 24/7.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with a king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
If it doesn't work, you're just not using enough. You're listening to Soft Web Radio, Special Operations Military News, and straight talk with the guys in the community.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to Soft Web Radio. I'm your host today, Steve Balistrieri. We have a great guest on the line with us, David Bull. Is it Gerfine or Gerfin?
Gerfine.
Gerfine. That's what I thought. Folks, David is a former Marine Lieutenant Colonel with a couple of combat tours under his belt. He is the CEO of United American Patriots, and we're going to get into all that and all the great things that they do. Who they're supporting, and I think all of our listeners will definitely want to tune into this and get involved with what they're doing and donate. I think it's a great organization, and we're going to get into all that. But before we get any further, we want to invite and welcome Bull to the podcast. Bull, thanks for taking the time with us this afternoon, and we welcome you, and we hope everything's going great today.
Awesome, Steve. Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me on.
No, it's a pleasure. So let's talk a little bit about your military career to start off with. I know that you enlisted in the Marines at 17, but then you went to Officer Candidate School. And talk us a little bit about your military career.
Yeah, I enlisted when I was 17 because I heard if you went to college, you had to read books, and I wasn't planning on doing any of that at the time. So Enlisted, ended up having a little battle with my dad over that, and he allowed me to go in the Marine Corps Reserves so long as I went to college, and that was kind of the trade-off. So I went to boot camp, Parris Island, South Carolina, and then after finishing my training, went up to college. And so that was kind of an interesting experience, going straight as a boot enlisted Marine, drinking the Kool-Aid up into a liberal college environment. So definitely a unique experience when I'm battling it out with our professors, some of whom said, yeah, I'm a communist, and I think America's destroying the world. I'm like, excuse me, I'd like to make a comment there. So needless to say, it was an interesting time in college. Then got commissioned, went on to become an infantry officer in the Marine Corps. Served 25 years with multiple combat and operational tours from Panama, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Afghanistan, Iraq, Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and ran around to a few other places like Korea and down to Africa, and just had an awesome tour. Very, very much operational and out there, really getting to see, the best of the best, serving with amazing Marines who trained me, educated me, and really couldn't have asked for a better tour. And I just have to make one correction, since we are 10 November is Marine Corps birthday, and just want to point out there are no former Marines. We are all Marines. Once a Marine, always a Marine. So we just want to make sure we keep that clear. And anyway, finished up my tour up on Capitol Hill. Wasn't intending to go that way, but was a part of helping to stand up MARSOC, Marine Special Operations Command, and doing the planning with that. And General Hale at the time said, hey, Bull, great job. What do you want to do? I said, hey, boss, you know me. I want to lead these guys into the first fight they have. It was good. Get up on Capitol Hill and fight for money. I said, what? So bottom line is I finished up on Capitol Hill representing MARSOC and Special Operations Command, making sure that MARSOC and now the Raiders had all the funding necessary to resource all the missions that they're doing. So, again, great career, loved it. And the only reason I retired is because I had a little girl on the way and decided to be a dad instead of going back to Afghanistan. So other than that, great tour, and loved every minute of it.
I read in your bio you were down in Panama. Was that during Just Cause and the whole Noriega mess?
Yeah, it was leading up to it. We were one of the infantry battalions down there that were setting the conditions for Just Cause. It was a part of the early stages. And our job was to actually conduct security and operational patrols out and around a couple of key installations in Panama against the Panamanian Defense Force, who were being advised by the Cubans at the time.
Yep. I was stationed down there at the same time. So,
wow.
Yeah, and it's a small country, so we probably weren't very far apart from each other. I was stationed with 3rd of the 7th over at Fort Davis, Panama. So,
oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, so we as you know, that's such a small place, so we couldn't have been too far apart. And so when I saw that, I just thought it was interesting. But
yeah, very interesting.
Yeah, it was a different time back then, wasn't it? I mean, a lot of things changed in the years after probably Desert Storm, which came the very next summer. You know, once all that kicked off, everything kind of changed. And the military, we have a lot better communications now than we did back then.
Well, that's definitely true. And I remember early on as a second lieutenant, around, I guess, 88, 89, you know, I started complaining to my company commander how I only had, you know, maybe about 20, 25 Marines in my platoon. And some of them were out doing various different fleet assistant programs and all the rest. And these company commanders just laughed at me and said, hey, before Reagan came around, you'd be lucky if you had a squad. So just be happy with the Marines you have. So it was definitely, you know, a turning point for the Marines leading up on, and for all the armed forces leading up to the first Gulf War, without a doubt.
Yeah, things changed. I entered the military still under the Carter administration. So I'm dating myself there. But then the Reagan years came along, and you know, I became an officer myself in 89. So that's, but anyway, no, that's very interesting. So, yeah, we probably passed each other on the highway a few times down in Panama.
Exactly. No doubt.
It was a great place to be stationed. I have no complaints. There's a lot worse places in the world to be stationed than in Panama. So
that's true.
I wish we still had our bases down there. So anyway,
you know, and it's interesting. At the time, we weren't really allowed off base. We were brought down there by the ambassador. He requested Marines coming down there because, unlike a lot of you guys who were doing the training up in the Jungle Warfare Training Center, the rest of the soldiers were there with their wives, their children, their cats, their dogs, the whole nine yards. And Noriega felt there was no way the United States would get into a conflict with him down in Panama because he knew that he had the high ground around all these bases and would be able to basically threaten to slaughter everybody had U.S. decided to come in. And that was a part of the reason the Marines were sent down there was we went down there, you know, just fully combat loaded without any attachments. And we were able to patrol the jungles without having the concerns of having a family with us down there. And so that was a part of setting the stage for operations with Just Cause.
Yeah. A lot of our guys who had been there a couple of years had their wives and kids stationed down there. And then they stopped that around, it must have been the end of 88, I would think.
Yeah.
And and then, of course, 89, a lot of the families were still there. But it is what it is. So we all came through it, and we're all better for it. So
absolutely.
So let's talk a little bit after your military career. I know you went into you worked for some defense industries, but tell us how you came about with United American Patriot.
Yeah, so it was interesting. I was approached probably about 6 years ago now by my former battalion commander. He was a battalion commander when I was a second lieutenant, and I had a tremendous amount of respect, still do have a tremendous amount of respect for this officer, Lieutenant Colonel Bob Wyman. He's the chairman of United American Patriots. And he started talking to me about this organization. And literally, I turned off when he was saying, yeah, these guys were convicted of war crimes, and we're going to sit here and fight for them. And it didn't make sense that, you know, myself and he and many others had, you know, been to combat, and none of our Marines had ever committed a war crime, much less been accused of murder. And here many of these individuals were accused of murder and were found guilty under the UCMJ by a military court-martial. And in my mind was, hey, you know, if they're found guilty, they're guilty. Let them rot. And it actually took him 3 years to try and get me on board. And it was only after I went up on Capitol Hill when they were putting on a presentation, and I finally sat and listened to what was going on. And it wasn't a matter of guilt or innocence. It was a matter of individual warriors who were having their rights violated. And it was about being set up against very restrictive rules of engagement that put them in harm's way. It was a denial of the presumption of innocence. A lot of these cases that at the time were under the Obama administration, where a lot of our warriors were pulled out of offensive missions, and now we're in sort of these defensive positions where they were being accused of just about everything, and the U.S. government was relying upon the Afghan government and basically just said, yeah, our guys are guilty, without ever finding out any of the details. And we would see time and again prosecutorial misconduct, which is where, for example, exculpatory information, which is information that shows that an accused did not commit a crime, was being hidden. We would see investigator abuse, where these investigators were trying to find a way to convict individuals and aligned with the prosecution, as opposed to trying to find the truth and the facts. We would find that there were other situations where unlawful command influence, where all of a sudden the commands, whether it be at the highest level of a civilian leadership or all the way down to military leadership, were stacking the decks against these warriors. And after I finally heard this, I got pretty upset, and I was asked if I wanted to speak, and I did. And I don't know that I brought down fire and brimstone, but I was definitely emotional. And then after that, I was asked to be UAP's CEO. And at the time, you know, my wife and I were looking at various different options in private industry that were going to provide tremendous base salaries and equity and bonuses and all the rest, all the financial trappings of a business career. And talked to my wife about it. And I said, hey, you know, what do you think about us just jumping on UAP for about 6 months or a year, just trying to help them out from a business standpoint? And she could see that she was concerned because it wasn't quite what we had lined up at the time. And she thought about it, prayed about it, slept on it. And the next morning she goes, we have to do UAP. And her perspective was, you know what? We can always make money. We're doing fine where we are right now. But now let's focus on these warriors who are being unjustly accused of war crimes, and let's take care of them. So we decided it was only going to be a few months to a year, and now it's been nearly 3 years that we've been on board, and it's paid off. Just last year, we were able to see the president pardon three of the warriors that we've been supporting. We had two warriors paroled and got out of prison. And then we have another five where their cases were overturned. And we just keep fighting to make sure that our warriors' rights are preserved.
I know. And, you know, it's funny you mentioned that because a lot of what you just said rang true with me. You know, we've all seen the military justice system when it comes to minor things. They've made mistakes, and we've seen that. But there was never any kind of – I don't want to say like I guess the correct word was of this kind of scope and magnitude where guys are being convicted of murder. And, you know, I was kind of the same way. You know, you read about these guys, oh, he's facing a court martial for murder an Afghan civilian Afghan civilian. And you automatically think, well, they must have done it, you know. And then it wasn't until later on, I was emailing back and forth with the attorney for Clint Warren, who you guys were very, very involved with his story. And then reading the transcript of everything that happened just absolutely blew me away how the government actually tried to railroad this kid.
Well, they did railroad him, no doubt about it. They convicted him of murder. And here was a first lieutenant, prior enlisted. So it wasn't just some, you know, boot lieutenant. He had experience. He was a staff NCO. And he made a call in combat where a motorcycle with three Taliban were heading towards his patrol. And he told his soldiers to open up. They did. They killed two of the three. His unit continued to be engaged. It wasn't a one-time incident. It was there was actually a U.S. Army report, a SIGAC, talking about how his unit was being set up for an ambush or an attack, and the government buried that. They didn't even introduce that as evidence. There was an aerostat operator, eye in the sky, that was watching what was happening, and the operator even said he saw Taliban with AK-47s and ICOM radios. He was very specific in what he saw that were shadowing Clint Lawrence's patrol at the time. And yet the government pressed to get a conviction, and they did. And in the courtroom, they kept talking about how Clint Lawrence killed civilians, and he was found guilty. And when United American Patriots got involved, and we were supporting the legal team of John Marr and his legal team, and had investigators over in Afghanistan run the biometrics on these so-called civilians. And as it turns out, they weren't civilians at all, that their DNA, their fingerprints, and other biometrics were all matching up with previous attacks on US soldiers from improvised explosive devices. So these guys had either wounded or killed other US servicemen. And in Zari, Afghanistan, they were taking tremendous casualties at the time. As a matter of fact, Clint Lawrence took over a platoon that the platoon leader had actually been medevaced with shrapnel wounds to his abdomen, face, and eyes. And that was just a couple of days prior to him taking over. So this was, you know, a pretty bad area. Clint made the right call, brought every one of his soldiers home alive. And the next thing you know, they just railroaded him. And if you look at the politics at the time, it was all because of the Obama administration trying to work with the Karzai administration to reduce what was being accused of too many civilian casualties. It was on the back-to-back of multiple different incidents that were creating a lot of political turmoil from U.S. Marine snipers who had actually taken out the guys who had been harassing and harming Marines and then pissing on their dead bodies and having that videotape. That created an outrage. You had guards at Bagram, Afghanistan, taking away books that the inmates were writing notes in and passing around and burning them. And it turns out they were all Qurans. And so all of a sudden, this looked like a horrible attack against Islam. And that created an uproar both in the United States and Afghanistan. And then you had Bob Bales, where he supposedly killed 16 civilians. And that's a whole separate case we could talk about. And again, no bodies, no evidence. It was all the Afghan word on what happened. And so it was one thing after another leading up to this. And then all of a sudden, Clint Lawrence's situation happened. And they're like, you know what? We just have to settle this. And a lot of it was that they were not going to sign, the Afghan government and the U.S. government were not going to sign the Status of Forces Agreement, which is a major legal agreement between countries as to who will handle criminal cases should they occur with U.S. military serving overseas. And that agreement was not signed until both Bob Bales and Clint Lawrence were found guilty of murder. And so there was a lot of political pressure there. And it wasn't until all of this was brought up and briefed out to the President of the United States that he was able to see through what was actually happening. And it was really a political lynching. And Clint Lawrence received a pardon from the president. So, you know, these are the type of cases that are shocking, that you can't really believe that our U.S. government would do this against our own U.S. servicemen, people who raise their hand to support and defend our rights. And yet they aren't getting the same rights as, you know, some civilian that might go into a school and start gunning down children. That individual will get more rights than a U.S. military person. So that's basically what UAP stands for, is defending the rights of our defenders.
Yeah. And, you know, again, going back to Clint, because we had him on the podcast as well after he was pardoned. And it was just absolutely, I mean, it was mind-boggling, because when you read about everything, like you mentioned, the eye in the sky, they were, you know, they were making a report that this unit was about to be hit. I mean, the guys were Taliban bomb makers. All of this information was available to the prosecution, and they wouldn't allow any of it to be shared.
It's exactly right. And not to mention that every one of the soldiers in his unit were accused of murder. And then they came around and said, all right, look, we'll give you all amnesty so long as – and then the commanding officer, the convening authority, ordered them to testify against Clint Lawrence. And, you know, so there's a lot that went on here that is just really mind-boggling. It's it's frustrating. There's a lot of challenges with the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And, you know, at the strategic level, there's a lot of things that need to be changed. But down at the tactical level, we're seeing time and time again, our warriors are just not getting a fair shake.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's too many of them, because looking at your website, I mean, you're looking at all the guys that you've been working with. It's it is mind-boggling, and it's awful. But I know that you've had quite a few success stories. I know... you know, we talked at length about Clint because, you know, I had got personally interested in that case. Has John Hartley been released yet?
I'm sorry, say that again?
John Hartley?
Yeah, John Hartley, we were able to get him clemency. He was put away for murder as well. We got him clemency and then pardoned, or supported him getting clemency and pardon. And he got out. And I think it's just been about a month ago now, and he's back home with his family. He got married, and he's doing well. And here's a perfect situation. Here's, you know, not just some young PFC that gets caught up in something. This is a first sergeant, highly decorated first sergeant. This guy was the guy who was out on multiple combat patrols, who was actually in hundreds of firefights. And as a first sergeant, you know, we all know those guys who are out there leading the fight, and then we know those who tend to sit back in the rear. This guy was out there with every patrol leading the way, and whenever there was a young lieutenant that would come into the command, you know, he would say to the battalion commander, hey, let me take him out so he gets some experience before he goes down there with his soldiers, because you know when I take him out, we're going to get into a firefight. And sure enough, that's what would happen. And so he was a warrior, you know, still is a warrior, but on the battlefield, he was fearless. And what ended up happening was he ended up getting convicted of murdering 4 detainees. And the crime was horrific, where he grabbed these 4 people out of a village, drove them down onto this farm by the side of a canal, and had his soldiers basically shoot them execution style, and then kicked them into the canal and took off. A horrific, horrific crime if it actually happened. And that's the problem, is that in that situation, they actually had CID go out and talk to the guy who owned the farm and said, can you tell us about when these guys came onto your farm? And they said, nobody ever came onto my farm. And they're like, well, maybe they did and you didn't know it. He goes, no, I would have known. And they said, well, do you mind if we look around? Help yourself. And they went out and they looked at the location where supposedly these 4 individuals were killed. You know, and they looked in the grass and the dirt, and they tried to find any sort of forensic evidence, like maybe blood splatter or bullets or shell casings or something. Nothing. Well, they figured, all right, well, maybe it all, you know, let's go get the bodies out of the canal. They put divers into the canal, and they dredged it. They searched that thing, and guess what? Not one body, not one bullet, not one casing, not one piece of clothing, not one bit of physical evidence. Well, they said, well, all right, well, let's go to the village then that apparently these civilians were taken out of, or these detainees were taken out of. And they said, is anybody missing? People said, no. Well, did anybody get killed? No. Like, well, listen, we have money here. You know, we're going to pay you if your family members were killed. They said, well, none of our family members were killed. So there was no physical evidence whatsoever. And yet they found him guilty, all based upon testimony of another individual who was being held accountable for crimes. And just the crimes were not as sexy, let's say, as murder. And so the prosecution and the CID all focused on this horrific murder case instead of really focusing on the problem of this one individual lying. And they coerced other junior enlisted soldiers to testify. And they said this never happened. And they produced documents saying that the first sergeant said, you did it. And here's his signature. They were all fake documents with forged signatures. And unfortunately, John Hatley, again, this highly decorated warrior, was put away for murder. And, you know, to meet him, though, his spirit is unbroken. He still loves his country, still loves the Army, doesn't like what happened to him through the UCMJ. But he's never admitted guilt, and he never will, because, you know, and they kept trying to hold him, said, listen, we're going to shorten your sentence, this and the other thing, if you admit guilt. He goes, I can't. I'm a staff NCO in the United States Army. I can't perjure my integrity for my own personal well-being. So I can't make up a lie. I can't say I did something I didn't. And fortunately, we were able to get him out, but, you know, he spent nearly a dozen years in prison. And these are the type of things that they're shocking when you get into the details. And we were able to present this to a bunch of congressmen who were shocked themselves. You know, where it gets worse, though, is that the U.S. Army circles the wagons when all of a sudden they're challenged, as opposed to saying, hold on a second, let's make sure we've got this right. And Congressman Flores out of Texas, he was one of the key congressmen who really took up the battle early on. And the family of John Hatley said, you know, sir, will you please look into this? And being, you know, a very intelligent and well-read congressman, he said, all right, you know, I'll meet with you. But he did his due diligence first, and he met with the Army. He found out all the details. And when he met with the family, he found out there were 2 separate facts, if you will. There was 2 separate realities. And it upset Congressman Flores because he saw that what the U.S. Army was telling him just wasn't true. And the evidence just wasn't there. And he really led the fight. And then we had Congressman Gohmert got on board. And we now have what's called a Justice for Warriors Caucus up on Capitol Hill with about a dozen congressmen who are really looking into all of these injustices to make sure that our warriors, when they enlist, when they get commissioned, when they go into combat, they're going to have their rights preserved. And that even if they do something wrong, they will have their rights preserved. And that's really the key here.
That I couldn't agree with you more there, because that's the most important thing. I mean, whether they're guilty or not, the one thing that our system always guarantees us is the right to a fair trial. And, you know, what I'm reading about a lot of these guys is they didn't get that.
Exactly.
So let me talk to you about your organization a little bit. Now, how does the UAPB go about helping these guys that obviously need your help? I know your background's an infantry officer, but do you have also lawyers on board?
So it's interesting. So our mission is to make sure that we inform the president, Congress, and the public, that we fund the legal representation, and then eventually we try to support the reintegration of our warriors who were wrongfully accused and unjustly convicted of war crimes. So we don't have any lawyers actually on board. And the reason that is that our warriors, we support them directly, but they can't afford civilian lawyers. They would have to mortgage their homes. They would have to, you know, beg, borrow, and steal from their family. They would have to do whatever it is. And most of the time, they still would fall short. So we say, look, you can choose whichever attorney you want, and then we will provide the financial support, not just for that attorney, but for any investigative work, any reports, anything that goes into supporting your case. So that way, we don't interfere with the attorney-client privilege. And yet at the same time, we work very closely with the attorneys, making sure that they're providing us information that we can share with our elected representatives. And we also make sure that as they're trying to do various different things, they're coordinating with us and saying, look, we need, you know, this sort of demonstrative report or a graphic or whatever. And we try to figure out how to support that. So our job really is, in a sense, a marketing arm trying to get this word out to the public, because we're all based on charitable donations. And unlike some of the other organizations out there that have multimillionaires and billionaires that throw in millions of dollars behind them, we're out there dealing with a grassroots movement where, you know, we have hundreds of thousands of individuals who are chipping in an average of about $39 a piece. And, you know, quite frankly, you know, our biggest supporters tend to be what I say is grandma in Peoria, who's, you know, these patriotic people in the heartland who are just like, you know, we're not going to allow this to happen to our warriors. And the more people find out, the more donations we get from across the board. You know, I think our largest individual donation was for $30,000, which is tremendous, but that's very rare. We've had, you know, a couple of others that have provided $10,000. And other than that, though, really, it's chips here and there. And part of that goes towards, as I said, providing that legal representation, but also making sure we're communicating up on Capitol Hill and making sure our elected representatives know what's going on.
Yeah, and when you're dealing with investigations, a lot of these cases are, I mean, let's face it, they're going to be in Afghanistan, Iraq, or wherever. It's not going to be a cheap investigation, because I'm sure, and like you mentioned earlier, the Army kind of circles the wagons. Have they been cooperative, the military, in some of these investigations, or is it kind of
not
like,
at all?
Yeah, I wouldn't imagine. I wouldn't imagine they had been.
Not at all. And they, you know, they go out of the way to hinder investigations. We saw Army Special Forces Matt Goldstein, who, you know, here's another great warrior who was doing everything he was supposed to be doing. And all of a sudden they accused him of killing a detainee, which was not the case. And this case went on for years. And it just, the U.S. government just said, we're going to find more evidence. We're going to find more evidence. And they sent an investigator over to Afghanistan to get more evidence. And I sat in on the motions hearing where this investigator, he was being questioned. And, you know, they asked him, like, so these individuals that you questioned, like, yes, these were family members of the individual that Matt Goldstein, quote unquote, murdered. And they said he was not Taliban. And so the question was, well, how did you know these were family members? They said, oh, well, the locals told us that they were. Like, okay, well, the locals there are all Taliban. So certainly you check their ID. And they said, well, no, they didn't have any ID. Well, wait a second. You brought them on to a U.S. military base. How could you do that? You can't bring random people onto a U.S. military base. And we have tremendous biometric databases to ensure that we're not bringing enemy combatants on the base. Well, that's true, but they didn't have ID, so we just brought them on. And then it gets worse. Then they sat them in the same room, and they started questioning them. And the question to the investigator is, wait a second, is that the best practice? Well, no, the best practice is to interview and interrogate people individually, but we didn't have a lot of room at the time, and we didn't have a lot of people that we could use to separate them. We're like, wait a second, this is a capital murder case that you're running against one of our most highly decorated special operators, and you couldn't find one other soldier to detain one of these quote-unquote witnesses while you interrogated one at a time? Well, you know, it couldn't happen, time, and it was every excuse you could imagine. And so the defense was, great, now we want to go over there and interview these same people. Oh, we can't do that because of security and a million and one other reasons. And it just, it's one of these things where they have all of the resources at their disposal. And only if they want to share those resources will the defense get the ability to go overseas, have the security, and be able to conduct interviews or investigations and all the rest. So it's very challenging. And we see it time and again where, you know, many cases, there are no bodies presented. So there's no forensics. So you can't really tell, you know, how the individual died. We had a first lieutenant, Michael Behenna, which was a unique case in that case, they actually did have the body and they actually did conduct forensics. And Behenna was accused of murdering this individual. And Behenna said, no, I acted in self-defense. And so the prosecution hired a forensic expert, one of the best in the country. And he went and said, yeah, based upon the forensics, Michael Behenna is telling the truth. It shows that the bullet wounds are consistent with Michael Behenna acting in self-defense. So what did the government do? They fired that expert and they buried that report. And that report never came to trial. And it wasn't until later on under appeal that all this was dug up. And, you know, fortunately, Michael Behenna, another great warrior, the president of the United States pardoned him because this is not we should not be conducting kangaroo courts. The rule of law must come paramount. And basically, the warriors, though, they actually fall under the laws of war, which are much different from even the rules of law. But we see this time and again. And those are the type of things where the government has to know there's a watchdog that's going to be checking everything that's happening here. And that's United American Patriots and the hundreds of thousands of people supporting us that are saying, look, if you want to find someone guilty, that's fine. We support that. We do not support you violating an individual's rights, especially not a warrior's rights.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
Finding the right news podcast can feel like dating. It seems promising until you start listening.
When you hit play on Post Reports, you'll get fascinating conversations and sometimes a little fun, too. I'm Martine Powers.
And I'm Elahe Azadi. Martine and I are the hosts of Post Reports. The show comes out every weekday from The Washington Post.
You can follow and listen to Post Reports wherever you get your podcasts. It'll be a match, I promise.
With dozens of streaming services, box office films, and content to choose from, people are spending over 2.5 years of their lives searching for what to watch. But The Hollywood Reporter brings you THR Charts, one place for you, your family, and friends to find the most watched TV shows and movies every week. THR Charts is a guide to help you spend less time scrolling through platforms so that you can spend more time watching and binging the content everyone is talking about, all supported by data and trusted sources like Nielsen, Comscore, and Paired Analytics. Check out THR Charts on HollywoodReporter.com.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
And I wanted to ask you about, there was one case that I had never heard of before, and that was First Lieutenant Sean Blair. And, you know, reading through your website, I never remember seeing this in any of the stuff that you see on the news or in publications or wherever. Can you fill us in a little bit about that?
You know, I apologize. I can't really talk in detail about Blair's case because that happened long before I came on board. So I don't know the details and I don't want to screw that up.
Okay, that's fine. That was just the one that stood out because I had never heard of that case before, but I know that they eventually got the charges dismissed, which is a good thing.
Absolutely.
Now, the UAP started, what, back in 2005? And it was a former Marine Corps officer that started it. Am I right?
That's true. It was Major Donahue, Bill Donahue. He was a Vietnam-era Marine, multiple Purple Hearts, multiple decorations, Bronze Star, Silver Star, just a true warrior, actually caught a round to the jaw as he was a door gunner doing an extract one time, and just an incredible individual who in 2005, he saw the Haditha and Hamdaniya Marines being marched around in orange jumpsuits and shackles. And we had congressmen calling them murderers. Jack Murray, you know, he was sitting here, you know, and he's a former Marine. He is one of the few former Marines. Everybody else, once a Marine, always Marine. But a lot of people feel he gave up his title once he started calling people murderers before they had even had their charges pressed against them. This was all hearsay, a lot of stories at the time. And that's, you know, an example of the highest level of unlawful command influence. So what happened was Major Donahue came along and said, no, that's not happening. And he actually mortgaged his house to get this organization started. And it took a long time for it to start gaining momentum. But he's still around, and he's a great individual, and he and I talk probably about once a week or so, and right now he's got some medical challenges, but he's a tough fighter, and he's not going anywhere.
Well, that's good to hear, and, you know, it's amazing that we have this many cases that's going on with our military, and I know, you know, we've been in combat for a very long time, but there shouldn't be this many cases that are out there. This guy's not having the correct amount of protection under our laws, because that's what we pride ourselves on.
So, absolutely.
You know, explain to our listeners how they can go about and help, how they can possibly volunteer if they want to get involved.
Absolutely. So, first of all, whenever we have anybody who wants to get involved, and we get phone calls quite often people who have interesting backgrounds, whether they be investigators, whether they be people who have contacts. A lot of times right now, we're talking to some interesting people in Hollywood who are working on trying to do documentaries and actually full feature films of some of the warriors that we're supporting and trying to get the word out there. So anytime somebody has a connection or a network that might be beneficial where they can find people with influence who can help out, certainly we welcome people calling in. Donations obviously are always appreciated. UAP.org, that's our website, UAP.org. And it's very easy to donate there. You can donate generally, or you can donate to an individual group of warriors. And we also have people, you know, that are local in Northern Virginia that come in and volunteer to help out with going through our mail, making phone calls on our behalf, and just trying to support as best they can.
So, Bull, tell us about some of the other cases that are ongoing with the UAP and how our listeners can get involved and let people know that they're supporting all of our warriors that are out there.
Certainly. So one of the cases that's relatively unique to UAP is the case in support of the MARSOC 3. And that's how we refer to them. It's two gunnery sergeants and one Navy chief, all three who are Raiders, who are with the Marine Special Operations Command. And this is a unique case in that there was an incident in which they had an aggressor going against them, and alcohol was involved on this aggressor's part, and he was being a little bit too aggressive that the instigator, he was pulled out of the bar that they were in. And this all actually happened in Erbil, Iraq. And it's strange that, you know, here in Iraq, which is considered in essence a combat zone, this was a relatively safe place in that soldiers and Marines were allowed off base. And this was New Year's and they were allowed out for a bit. And next thing you know, incident happens. Navy Chief Gilmet, he was being harassed by this civilian contractor who actually used to be a former Army Special Forces. And he was escorted out of the bar. And next thing you know, the Raiders were asked to hold and, you know, let him kind of take off so there wouldn't be an incident. They were kind of waiting outside for a fight. And they finally walked away. And as the Raiders left, Chief Gilmes telling Gunnery Sergeant Danny Dreher what happened, and that some sort of a conflict was here. And, you know, Gunnery Sergeant Dreher, being a good senior staff NCO, said, all right, well, we can't have conflicts. We're all sitting out here working together for the same mission against real bad guys. So he decides to go over and talk to this contractor and basically say, hey, you know, what's going on? Let's knock this off. And the contractor didn't take kindly to it, was very aggressive, started poking Gunnery Sergeant Dreher in the chest, just kind of yelling and spitting on him. And next thing you know, he makes this aggressive move towards him. Danny Dreher pushes him away. And next thing you know, his contractor comes at Danny Dreher, swings, hits him twice. And Danny's kind of shocked because he's like, you know, what the hell's going on? One of the other Raiders, Gunnery Sergeant Negron, Josh Negron, about 155 pounds, small guy, you know, half the size of his contractor. And Danny, he steps in, hits the contractor once, contractor goes down. And basically, the, you know, all the contractor's friends, they kind of say, all right, well, whatever, and they kind of walk off. And yet you got these three Raiders, you know, these guys were born to serve. You know, these are some of the best of the best. They, you know, enlisted in the Marines, then were force reconnaissance Marines, and then went on to be Raiders. I mean, these are some of the best of the best that we have. They're like, all right, we're not leaving this guy in the street, you know, in Iraq. You know, even if, you know, he was intoxicated and was acting a little bit too aggressive, you know, we're going to take care of this guy. They bring him back to their barracks there. And well, it wasn't barracks, I guess the garrison where they were staying. And Chief Gilmet, who was the senior medical advisor at the time, you know, here's a special independent duty corpsman, special operations independent duty corpsman, you know, one of the best trained medical advisors we have, or practitioners, I should say. He assesses him, says, look, all his vitals are good, everything's fine. Let's just put him in the rack. Let's watch him for a bit and make sure he's stabilized, which he was. And then they advised one of the other contractors, keep an eye on him. And at a certain point, apparently the contractor stopped breathing. And the other contractor grabbed Chief Gilman and the rest, and they came and tried doing some heroic life-saving steps on this guy. And they medevaced him out. He ended up going to Landstuhl, Germany. And unfortunately, 4 days later, he died. And the determination was he asphyxiated. He threw up and ended up swallowing his own vomit into his lungs and died. Horrific situation. Like, this is not, nobody's celebrating, like, hey, the Marines beat up Special Forces guy. Like, not at all. This was a horrible situation. But there was, again, a rush to judgment, to where all of a sudden the commanding general of MARSOC, General Yu, he's sitting here, making condolences to the family, goes to the funeral of this contractor, and the rumors start spreading that these raiders basically had boot stomped this contractor, and three of them against one, and they beat him up, and it was, this drunken murder, and it was just, the stories were horrific. And yet again, there was no assessment of what actually had happened yet. And before you know it, these three raiders, they lose their security clearances. They're pulled out of they're out of the line. So they're not even doing what they're supposed to be doing. They're, basically working in the barracks, working the gym, working, basically handing out crap in the hospital. And nobody had actually even asked them what had happened. Again, it was a presumption of guilt. And a lot of this goes to the, sort of the misconception and the prejudice against our special operators that, these guys are cowboys and, they don't abide by the rules. We need to tighten them up. They need more discipline. And, here's an example of, we're going to make an example of these three guys. Like, this is not what you do when you go off base. You don't get into fights. You don't do it. But they didn't start the fight. And they acted appropriately every step of the way, trying to de-escalate the situation and even caring for this individual. Now, how do we know that that's the case? Because all of this was captured on security cameras. And you see step by step that every step of the way, even inside the bar, outside talking to them, that at every point of the way, they were trying to de-escalate the situation. They were not trying to create a fight. And yet the prosecutors came in here. They've charged these three with manslaughter, and they're trying to hold them accountable. Again, the Article 32 hearing, even the judge says, this looks like it might be a case of self-defense or defense of others. And yet they're moving forward with a court-martial. And, it's one of these things where the presumption of guilt is holding over these guys, as opposed to the commander saying, we're going to go with the presumption of innocence. And a part of that is the commanders could easily say, well, I did the right thing. I referred it to court-martial. We'll allow the facts to play out there, as opposed to saying, from everything I see, I'm going to make a command decision because I am a commander who has been put here supposedly because I know how to make the right decisions. And yet when it comes to legal matters or administrative matters, we defer to the courts. And unfortunately, depending on where you are in various different conflicts, we've seen up to 98% conviction rates in court martials. That the system is so lopsided that you're basically condemning these guys. You're not giving them a fair fight. And just to kind of go into why that is, that in cases where you've got court martials concerning murder, that you don't need a unanimous jury. You only need 3/4 of the jury. And other cases, you only need 2/3 of the jury. And why is that really bad? Because again, that's the presumption of guilt. You're not giving these guys the benefit of the doubt, that you don't give them the presumption of innocence as a civilian court does. Secondly, where it's frustrating is that the convening authority, the one who's calling this court martial, he presents the soldiers or Marines who are going to be sitting on the trials, court martial, in the jury. And so the deck is getting stacked to begin with. And why this is really terrible is, if you think about it, if I, as a retired Marine or any civilian, gets selected for jury duty out in the civilian world, we will go, we'll sit there in the jury, we'll listen to the facts, and we'll make a determination based upon how we assess the facts and perhaps our own moral or ethical convictions, And we'll come out and we'll say innocent or guilty, or guilty, not guilty. But that's not the case in the military, because there's another factor that comes into play. And that factor is, how will my decision impact my career? How will it impact my personal life? Now, this is a very different situation, because that shouldn't come into play at all. But it does, because let's say you're one of the one third that finds someone not guilty. And let's say your boss happens to be sitting on that panel, on that jury. Now, all of a sudden, the boss is going to go back to the convening authority and say, hey, guess what? Gerfein, I'm questioning his judgment. You know, he thought they were not guilty. Obviously, you, commanding general, thought they were guilty because you referred them to court-martial. I voted for them to be guilty, and they were found guilty. But Gerfein, I'm not so sure about him. And to think that that won't impact someone's career when it's within the same command, especially in the tight-knit special operations community, that could be a kiss of death. So I'd like to believe that any of our warriors that are sitting on juries are going to make the right ethical decision regardless of how it would impact them personally. However, you just don't know that to be true. And you just don't realize that, you know what, somebody might have to pay a mortgage, and them losing their career, that might hurt that. And so now they're thinking about their family, their house, their dog, their cat. Again, none of that should play into a decision that's going to determine the fate of someone else's life. And this is really challenging. And this kind of brings us to another case where Staff Sergeant Gibbs, right now, he's up for clemency. This is an individual warfighter who was found guilty of murder. Again, no hard evidence, no bodies, no forensics, nothing. It was purely based upon testimony by others that found him guilty. And it was others who were actually looking out for their own well-being. And that was enough to convict them. Convict him, Staff Sergeant Gibbs. And what's interesting is that in Staff Sergeant Gibbs' case, you know, here's an infantry staff NCO, and yet there was not one infantry soldier sitting in the jury. As a matter of fact, I believe they were all military policemen, and which is bizarre, because where the court-martial actually took place is actually where the 2nd Infantry Division is garrisoned. So certainly they could have found at least one infantry soldier that could have sat there on the jury, and yet they didn't. They stacked it with military policemen that have a different perspective from our infantry. And so it would be, you know, imagine somebody going and, you know, being accused of a crime and packing the jury with police officers. Like, you don't do that. And that's exactly what happened here in Calvin's case. And we saw in Calvin's case, again, the 3 individuals that testified against Calvin, not only were they looking out for their own well-being, but they were allowed to talk amongst themselves, actually while smoking hashish, driving around Kandahar Air Force Base, and corroborate their story to make sure that they sold the squad leader, Calvin Gibbs, down the road. And moreover, in Gibbs' case, we saw that there were 2 material eyewitnesses who could have come in and said, yeah, Calvin Gibbs did not commit these crimes, did not commit murder. And yet they were not brought in to testify. So these are the type of things where, you know, Staff Sergeant Gibbs, people have raised other issues about some of the things he did wrong. It's like, great, hold him accountable for that which he did wrong. But you can't parlay that into, oh, well, he did these things wrong, so obviously he's a murderer. That's not the way it works, because you have to find hard evidence. And yet we see time and again that even with evidence like the videotapes in the MARSOC 3 case, or in this case with Staff Sergeant Gibbs and others, where you don't have hard evidence, that guys are being found guilty. And again, hold people accountable for what they did wrong. But do not trump up charges. Don't get overzealous prosecutors who are trying to get bigger kills. And just so people understand, back in World War II, when we used to have court-martials, that the way that would be done is they'd say, hey, let's grab this infantry officer and this artillery officer and, you know, have them be the defense and have them be the prosecution, and let's find out the truth in this individual case. And that's not what's happening anymore. Now we have professional attorneys, and these attorneys go from law school. They go through 16 weeks of training to figure out how to put their uniform on and learn military jargon. And then the next thing you know, their careers are based upon their prosecutions. How successful are they in getting quote-unquote kills under their belt, which are fellow servicemen? And so unlike the World War II infantry officer or artillery officer that played attorney that then would go back to their career and be assessed for promotion based upon, you know, whether they were good infantry officers or artillery officers, these attorneys are being held accountable as attorneys. So they've got a very different mindset. And that's troubling when all of a sudden you've got these professional attorneys that have an incentive within the armed forces under the same convening authority to try and find guilt. And it sets them up for prosecutorial misconduct, for hiding exculpatory information, for trying to get a bigger kill. Like for somebody to get a murder case or a manslaughter case instead of, you know, just saying, well, okay, that we don't see it here. It sets up a very troubling precedent, especially when we have never had one military prosecutor being held accountable for prosecutorial misconduct, a crime, never once. Like administratively, perhaps, they may have been moved off a case or something else, but they've never been held criminally accountable, and they should. You know, we could talk about Eddie Gallagher's case, where I know there's a lot of conflict there. Some people, you know, are concerned about how that whole case played out. But at the end of the day, the prosecutors spied on the attorney-client privilege. They put spyware on emails that they were sending to the defense attorney. That is a criminal act. And what happened to that prosecutor? Well, they just moved him off the case. No, that's a criminal act. Why wasn't he held accountable? And time and again, we see this happening. And for them, when they look at the risk reward, it's like, well, if I get a kill here, I get promoted. If I get caught, oh, well, no big deal. There's no real downside for these guys. And that's where we need to start holding people accountable and making sure that the right things are happening at the right time for the right reasons. Again, we're not determining innocence or guilt. We're just preserving the individual's rights. And if I can just talk about that one more piece, there are organizations out there like the Innocence Project or the ACLU that if they hear that there's an individual, a civilian, sitting on death row for committing some horrific crime, whatever it is, rape, murder, whatever you want to imagine, the most horrific crime you can imagine, and yet they find out that, guess what? That individual's rights were violated, whether it's unlawful search and seizure or inappropriate, you know, the wrong DNA was identified or anything else, that individual, they will fight as hard as they can to get that individual off of death row. And quite frankly, that's the right thing to do, because any individual's wrongdoing does not outweigh all of our rights. Our rights must be preserved. And yet, we don't see these same organizations fighting for our warriors when our warriors are having their rights preserved. And as we all know, the only reason that we have our rights is because we have individual warriors that are willing to support and defend our Constitution, which is our rights. And those warriors don't get the same benefit of the doubt. They don't get the presumption of innocence. They don't get the same standards of a civilian court. And so this is where UAP.org, we're going to continue to fight to make sure that our warriors are having at least equal justice.
That's, I think that's fantastic. And, you know, I think all of our listeners fully support that. I mean, again, you talked about misconduct. I'm getting all tongue-tied this afternoon. Yeah, and, you know, the first thing that came to mind was the Eddie Gallagher case. And, you know, what happened there was just, again, mind-boggling. And then, I, like I said, I was, you know, heavily read in on what was going on with Clint Lawrence, but there's many more cases that you guys have been involved with, obviously. And it's just, it's shocking because we don't usually equate that with the country that we live in. We're supposed to be the people that play by the rules and take care of everyone. And we take care of our civilians for the most part in the civilian courts, but we're not doing a good enough job when it comes to the military guys.
Well, that's definitely true. I mean, you know, here's another situation is Staff Sergeant Bob Bales. And this is, case, the Kandahar massacre. And Staff Sergeant Bales confessed to killing 16 civilians. And whether or not he actually killed 16 or, as some would say, 20, and whether or not they were all civilians, we don't know. Why? Because the U.S. government never saw the bodies, never conducted forensics, never did autopsies. The Afghan government claimed that's what happened, and that was it. It wasn't until a month after, when all the bodies had been buried, and well, they were buried the next day, that CID actually went out and conducted a limited investigation because they were told that it's too dangerous of an environment for them to be out there. But they conducted a very limited investigation, and they came back and they held Bob accountable for these crimes. And, you know, here's an individual where, you know, Bob was frustrated. He felt that, again, the defensive posture that was happening at the time was not conducive to how they should be prosecuting the war. And he basically decided to take the war into his own hands and step off base and go out with the intent to kill enemy combatants. And unfortunately, he did kill civilians, and he acknowledges that. And that still haunts him. But what ends up happening is that when he came back, that there was this rush to judgment. They immediately put the death penalty on the table, and they said, look, sign this confession that you killed these 16 civilians, or we're going to hold you accountable for the death penalty, and we're going to take you to trial, and we're going to find you guilty. And they pressured him. The prosecution pressured him. They had others who were saying, look, Bob, just sign this confession because there's so many people, U.S. troops, that are now, their lives are endangered because what you did. And then you had his defense attorney saying, Bob, just sign this so they don't hold you accountable for the death penalty. And his own wife said, Bob, please do whatever it takes so they don't kill you. We have two children. And Bob's an amazing family man. Even while he's been in prison, he does homework with his kids. His kids go in and visit with him, or at least they did before the COVID lockdowns. And he's sitting here doing homework with his kids and talks to his kids all the time. His wife moved close to the prison so that they can maintain a relationship. I mean, this is not some, you know, horrible, horrible, evil monster as they point him out to be. However, here's the thing. Even if Bob committed these horrific crimes and decided to walk off base by himself and do this, well, anybody who knows the facts of the case, they immediately say, wow, that's crazy. You know, him walking off by himself to engage the enemy, that's crazy. And yet, he was never tested to see if, in fact, he was crazy. And in the civilian courts, if someone walked into a high school or a grade school or Sandy Hook or what have you and starts gunning down children, that after that individual is taken into custody and read his rights, the next thing that happens is before they go through a trial, they actually test for what's called his mens rea. Did he have the mental capacity to understand that what he was doing was completely wrong, that he was crazy in essence? And yet they never thought to test Bob for that. As a matter of fact, it gets worse because a lot of operators who I know who are listening to this right now will realize, like myself, we took Larium or Mefloquine. This is an anti-malaria drug. And I know in 2002, when I took this, that I started having weird hallucinations right after I took this frickin' thing and I stopped taking it. And we had three special operators that returned from Afghanistan at the time, and they killed their wives. And it's been shown that this drug has been linked to really horrific nightmares and paranoia and all sorts of psychological problems. And yet the prosecution, again, did not even bring this into the case. Nobody even discussed the fact that Bob had taken Larium or Mefloquine, which could have altered his psyche. In essence, he could have been crazy. And instead, they pressured him to make a confession. And so he made this confession. And the next thing they did, this is where it gets worse. They then went to the sentencing portion. Now, because he made a confession, they took the death sentence off the table and they said, all right, well, we're going to bring in what's called impact witnesses. So they decided to fly in what they said were Afghan farmers into the country and then put them on Delta Airlines with other U.S. citizens, flew them over to testify against Bob. And they all told these horrific stories and how it was horrible that family members were killed and all the rest. And then the prosecution took them to SeaWorld and took them out to dinner and took care of them and then flew them back to Afghanistan. Now, we know this for a fact because we have all the receipts and all the rest. But what was interesting is they brought them in under false names with false passports. Now, why would they have done that? Well, when again, UAP supported the attorneys and the investigators going doing the homework, they found out, wait a second. These guys might be farmers during the day, but at night, these guys are dyed-in-the-wool Taliban. So while we're at war in Afghanistan, our country, our government flew in enemy combatants, not just some random civilian, enemy combatants to come in and testify against a U.S. serviceman. Like, that's the type of thing where that can't be tolerated. And so as horrific as Bob's crimes may be, you can't allow this precedent to stand where our U.S. government thinks it's okay to collaborate with the enemy to try and put someone away for life. And that's exactly what happened. Bob's been put away for life. So these are the type of things where, again, you know, people want to argue all the time, well, what Bob did was horrible. Okay, great. Bob will even tell you what he did was horrible. And he'll tell you that, you know what? Hold me accountable for what I did wrong. But at the same time, you can't take away an individual's rights. That's where the system has to be addressed. And we have to make sure we're fighting because, quite frankly, maybe Bob's case is not peculiar to everyone else here, but any of our other warriors that are out there, when they pull the trigger, they've got to realize that depending upon how that gets assessed, the next thing you know, they could end up in a court martial. And we know, we've seen this time and again, that the enemy makes false claims against us all the time. The enemy puts civilians in harm's way so that we get the media turning against the warriors all the time. They understand, and they're ruthless in how they do it, how they play the propaganda game. And we, because we're a compassionate country, we tend to fall for this. Or at least we question our own troops first. And the first thing we should be doing is, hold on a second. Let's question the source. Let's find out what's going on here. And then let's make sure we're giving our warriors the rights that they deserve, the rights that they fight for. And again, if we find that these warriors are guilty, hold them accountable. That's what we do. But not at the expense of destroying their rights.
And I think that sums it up perfectly for what UAP does, what you guys are, and who you're supporting. And we want to thank you for doing what you do. And I know you said you planned on 6 months to a year. It doesn't sound like you're leaving anytime soon, does it?
No, I'm coming up on 3 years, and we're going to stick it through. We're going to keep fighting. And one of the other areas, since fortunately, you know, We're drawing down on a lot of conflicts, and so we don't receive a lot more war crimes coming in, which was really our niche. We started focusing on unrecognized valor. And one of the big cases we're looking at is actually a hero in the special operations community, Major Jim Capers. And Major Jim Capers was one of the early force reconnaissance Marines in Vietnam who really set the standard for a lot of the tactics, techniques, and procedures that our force reconnaissance Marines and our raiders are using to this day. Absolute hero, unbelievable. Like every one of his patrols were just like incredibly heroic in his leadership. He did scuba missions in Vietnam. He did long range reconnaissance patrols. He did recovery patrols. He did a lot of black ops that still have not been uncovered. And yet the ones that have been uncovered really are representative of a warrior who's deserving of the Medal of Honor. And yet, at the same time, this warrior did not get the Medal of Honor. And we're coming in to figure out what exactly happened. There's some administrative questions. There's been some closed meetings that we're discussing this, where we're going to go forward. We're going to do FOIAs to find out exactly what was discussed and why this warrior didn't get the Medal of Honor. There have been claims of racism. This is one of the first African-American Force Reconnaissance Marines who actually got a battlefield commission and kept his battlefield commission while he was in Vietnam and kept it when he came home. He actually, Major Jim Capers was a poster child, literally, for the Marine Corps. One of the most successful Marine Corps advertising campaigns was Ask a Marine, and it had his photograph in dress blues, which was a highly successful campaign for the Marine Corps. So this is an absolute heroic warrior across the board who we're trying to figure out what went wrong and why this warrior didn't get the Medal of Honor. And, you know, we don't want to sit here and say, well, you know, it was race-based. You know, we don't know that to be true. We know there's a lot of indicators that individuals didn't like him, and it seems like it was based upon race. But the facts remain that Major Jim Capers, he paid for this award with blood, sweat, and tears, regardless of anything else. And the fact that the Marine Corps has never had one African-American Marine Corps officer who's ever received the Medal of Honor, that's a little bit surprising. But again, I'd like to give the benefit of the doubt to the Marine Corps that it's merit-based. And so we're going to look at this, and we're going to make sure that, you know, all the T's are crossed, all the I's are dotted. And, you know, here's a warrior who was just recognized by the Special Operations Command. He was put into the Hall of Honor down there in Tampa. And he was one of two Marines that were inducted. And so he's gone through a lot of scrutiny and a lot of background checks. So it's not just some random individual, but this is someone who has been recognized and his background has been looked at thoroughly. And we're honored to actually be working with Major Jim Capers and others to figure out exactly why he hasn't received this Medal of Honor. And we're going to press to make sure that, again, the truth comes out, light gets shined on it. And if the man's deserving of the Medal of Honor, then by God, we're going to make sure that he gets that awarded to him.
I've spoken to Jim Capers on the phone for quite a couple, probably a couple of hours one afternoon. He's a tremendous individual, and he's getting up there in age a little bit now. But, boy, you know, when you read his stories and you read the combat missions he was on, it reads like a Pulp Fiction book, because you think to yourself, how could anyone survive all this stuff? And he did. He's an amazing man. And we salute your efforts on that as well, because I think, you know, when you talk about people that are deserving, he should be at the top of the list.
Absolutely. He's a role model. He's a mentor. He's still involved with MARSOC and the Raiders. He still provides advice and guidance. And like you said, he's getting up there in years, and he's, you know, in his mid-80s. And, you know, he jokes with me. He's like, I only got a few more years left. I'm like, you know, Jim, the only way you're leaving this planet is when you're ready to go, because ain't nobody going to be able to take your life. So yeah. He cracks up. He's still got a sense of humor. And what's great about him, he doesn't play the race card. He doesn't say, well, you know, there was race. He doesn't do that. He's just wants to make sure that if he's deserving, that he gets awarded, but not even so much for him. It's more for recognition of those who serve with him. And there are others that also did not receive awards that were deserving. And we're trying to make sure that all of those warriors that serve with him in Vietnam, that they are awarded the appropriate awards. And this is not something that just gets brushed under the carpet, because, again, this is our legacy. This is what our warriors, we need heroes who are actually warriors and not have medals of honor given out just for people who, you know, were in defensive actions, that, you know, were doing some sort of humanitarian action, or, you know, they received the award posthumously. Like, our warriors locate, close with, and destroy the enemy with extreme prejudice. And we need the young warriors that are coming up behind them to realize, like, that is appropriate. And that is what gets recognized for valor. And Jim Capers, by God, he took the fight to the enemy. he tells me stories, you know, one of which where he saw some a local village that had actually been terrorized by the Viet Cong, and the village elder, they cut him open and hung him up, and so his innards were hanging out for the pigs to eat while he was alive. I mean, just a horrific way for somebody to die, and they did it intentionally to terrorize anybody else who would interact with the U.S. military. And Capers had a relationship with this village and the village elder. And I'll tell you, the story of how Jim went after these guys with a vengeance, and he tracked them down. And like, his tracking skills were phenomenal. And he was talking about the details, and he went after them, and he took them out with extreme prejudice. And those are the type of actions that's not even the ones that he's being looked at for the Medal of Honor. But those are the type of things where his warriors, they fought the right fight. And we hear too many stories that get blown out of proportion by the media about, oh, you know, the baby killers over in Vietnam, and everybody was smoking pot and committing crimes. And, you know, that makes for a good movie. But that wasn't the majority of our warriors. And that's why when you find a true warrior like this, who's representative of all that is good and right about the warrior ethos, about how they conducted operations in Vietnam, that story must be told. And it has to be told loudly and broadly so that America realizes that those warriors that served in Vietnam, for the most part, were honorable warriors. And they cannot be blackened by this disgrace of marring them with the few incidents that really were horrible, but were not indicative of how most of the warriors acted over in Vietnam. So we're fighting for Jim Capers to make sure that he receives the recognition he deserves, and that story gets told across the nation, and he gets heralded as the hero that others need to emulate.
Well, I think that's, again, you know, after speaking with Major Capers and talking to him on the phone, he's such a low key, you know, he's not, he's very humble, and he's just a great man. And we wish you all the luck with that, because I think, again, he's very, very deserving. And sir, thank you for all you do for all our veterans that are out there that need your help. I mean, you know, you've explained to our listeners how they can go about volunteering or donating. And if they know anyone, they can contact your organization and put them in touch with the people that can help them. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the fact that, on a personal note, I noticed that you prevented Jack Nicholson from beating up Tom Cruise in A Few Good Men. So we couldn't let you go without mentioning that. There's probably some of our listeners that probably wish you had. So we won't get into that too much. But, yeah, you were in that film. And that, I guess, we'll leave that as it is today. But that's probably fodder for another podcast, maybe in the future.
Yeah, Steve, all I can say about that is you can't handle the truth.
There you go. It's like, because you need me on that wall.
Exactly. And that's the only thing anybody really cares about my military career. Nothing else matters. It's like, oh, you were in a movie? Oh, all right.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, we'll talk about that on another podcast some other time. But we really want to thank you for being here today and telling us all about, you know, UAP and what you guys are and who you are and who you're helping. And all of us here at SoftRip appreciate that. But before we go, I need to read one little quick blurb to all listeners out there. If you want to get SoftRip on your phone, download our free mobile app and get easy access to articles, podcasts, and great reviews, all perfectly formatted to your device. Please subscribe to SoftRip.com to get access to all our library of ebooks and our exclusive team room forums and content available on all Apple and Android devices.
You've been listening to Soft Rep Radio.
So I know you've got a lot going on, but remember, I'm here for you. So bother me when no one's listening, because I will. Bother me when it feels like it won't get better, because it can. Bother me because you're never a bother. Whether it's a low point or a crisis, get help for yourself or a friend. Learn more at neverabother.org or call or text 988, available 24/7.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
With dozens of streaming services, box office films, and content to choose from, people are spending over 2.5 years of their lives searching for what to watch. But The Hollywood Reporter brings you THR Charts, one place for you, your family, and friends to find the most watched TV shows and movies every week. THR Charts is a guide to help you spend less time scrolling through platforms so that you can spend more time watching and binging the content everyone is talking about, all supported by data and trusted sources like Nielsen, Comscore, and Paired Analytics. Check out THR Charts on HollywoodReporter.com.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.